Before we get to the end of the text, and Mike had a question, I know. First, I have a question for you. Has anyone tried? Let's see, last time, not everyone was here. I don't know who's here one week or the other. Mike was. There's no continuity. I was about to say, last time, as we were discussing, but only Mike was here. Oh, Kathy was here, okay. Anyway, last time we talked about the way the middle section of the sutra gives kind of like meditation instructions, listing off different classes of beings that you might wish loving kindness towards, but that's not the way meditation is usually done. Remember, we talked about how it's usually done, the series of four groups of people, where you bring up one person as an example, the first example being yourself.
I did for myself and one other.
Yeah.
And for the next step, I've done about four.
Oh, great, yeah. So I was going to ask, you know, how was that? What happened?
it was good.
Yeah.
I listened to a tape by Sharon Salzberg.
Oh, she's a big proponent of this meditation, yeah. Yeah.
I think she recommended it for yourself, if I remember right.
Yeah, what did she say?
May I have safety? May I have mental health? May I have physical health? May I live at ease?
Uh-huh.
That worked fine for me, and then when I got to a person, the next one I was going to go, somebody I'm real comfortable with, having compassion.
Yeah.
And it seemed like she's going through sort of a crisis right now, and I wanted to add something in, so I said, maybe she had the inner strength to cope with the current situation.
Yeah.
I just chopped it off because I'm trying not to think,
Right.
This,
yeah.
Maybe she had the inner strength.
Yeah.
And it works. I used to do it before quite a while ago.
Uh-huh.
Listened to a tape by Pema Chodron. And I always felt that when I was doing that, I just felt a lot better about people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of saying, what's that jerk doing? I think, that's sweet.
Yeah.
That's all right.
Anybody else dabble in meta practice? It's okay if you didn't. Yeah.
Well, you know, I always have trouble with myself. I'm just, I think you suggested last week that we actually take the whole, like a whole chunk of time just for doing ourselves, and I have difficulty with that.
What happens is the mind just sort of veer off and think about something else, or is there a whole sort of story about why that's not right? Or
and it's not real conscious, it's just this, in terms of the thought story.
Yeah.
It's just this, feeling, just this stuff, you're not supposed to be doing this for yourself. It's a selfish thing to do or something. So, I gotta, I used to have trouble with George Bush and everything.
Now he's off the scene, yeah.
Well, he's off the scene, but, there's sort of like folks out there.
I'm a little bit lost. Was there some assignment we were supposed to do or something?
Well, last week, I don't think you were here, we talked about the traditional directions for metta meditation. I think you weren't here, Joan, so that's why you don't remember that. Well, that's okay, no biggie.
Okay.
And for myself, I've been noticing, for one thing, in Zazen, I'm sort of habituated to what I usually do. I just forget, that's an interesting sort of aspect of these kind of practices. You just simply don't think of them, And that makes me wonder, is there a reason why you forget? Maybe so. Maybe there's some subtle sort of level of resistance. But what I have been noticing is that I've been really trying to bring up the sort of spirit of loving kindness whenever I encounter anybody. And kind of like Mike was saying, was sort of a result of the meditation. I was trying to actually just practice that result. That when I first encounter somebody, to see if the first, and I'm going to talk more about this later, to see if the first thought I have is, may this person be happy, may they be healthy, may they be safe. And what I find interesting is when you do that, you notice that becomes also a sort of an awareness practice, that you noticed all the other thoughts that were sort of queued up, you know what I mean, that were triggered. And it's especially sort of interesting to me and obvious with strangers, you know. Like, there's no reason you should have any opinion about this person, you know what I mean? You would think an objective, we think we're objective, right? You think an objective mind would just cognize a person walking and that would be the end of it, you know? But no, you know, it's like the least sort of like sort of curve of a shape on their body or the way they're holding their body or their expression or, you know, whether they're talking to their cell phone, there's all these sort of triggers that release all these great sort of stories and judgments and, you know, this whole hullabaloo is let loose in the mind, you know, and which makes me realize that's why we need meditation practice, you know, is that our minds are constantly sort of being triggered and we're having this incredible sort of complicated, noisy journey, inner journeys, you know, and so there's not so much opportunity to actually notice what's really happening because we're sort of caught up, you know, then as soon as that ends, someone else is going to walk by, right? And then someone you actually know is going to show up and that really is going to trigger something. So it's been interesting to me both to see how that sort of shifts my feeling when I see somebody, cognize somebody, and also sort of what that says about what else I would have thought of. So anyway, I think it's pretty interesting.
Excuse me, I just wanted to, I thought we didn't meet last Friday because you couldn't be here.
Well, it was 2 weeks ago we skipped. So yeah, skipping one is confusing. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, we skipped one 2 weeks ago and then we took up again last week. Yeah, sorry. And I did, and I have been pretty careful about recording them and keeping my notes organized. So we'll have kind of a self-study course on the website too.
Oh,
so
yes.
You can listen that way if you... And then we'll ask the librarians to burn copies for those that can't do computer, you know, if it seems like a useful sort of course. So anyway, where we left off in terms of our sort of line-by-line study of the sutta, let's just remind ourselves about that and catch Joan up. We got through the, I think we got through the 8th verse. And remember, the sutta is understood to kind of have kind of 3 sections. First being qualities of morality that are useful, that are either a prerequisite for metta practice or developed with metta practice, is the first section. So we want to back all the way up? Let's back all the way up. First one. So the first like 2.5 verses were all these qualities, remember? That you're easy to support, that you're not burdened by riches, that you're wise, you know, that you're seeking the good, and so on and so forth, right? And then the middle of the 3rd verse transitioned with the famous line, "May all beings be happy," into a bunch of instructions, basically, meditation instructions. How do you practice this? Well, you wish this for all living beings, whether they're weak or they're strong, you know, whoever they are, whether they're visible or invisible. May they all be happy. And then not only do we wish all these beings happy, but then starting on the other page and verse 6, then we also consider how are we in relationship to all these beings? Or, you know, how can we be with other beings without ever deceiving them, without being stuck in hatred or harmful states? And in fact, can we treat everybody, you know, without exception, with the same sort of love and care that a sort of idealized mother would have for her only child? And we talked a little bit about, well, that's just a simile, you know, if you have a terrible relationship with your mother, then maybe you just pick another simile, you know. and then verse 8 talks about just sort of the infinite extent of this. You know, not only should we have this incredibly, could we, you know, not only is it possible to imagine having this incredibly loving an unconditionally positive relationship with all beings like they're our children, but we can extend this outward just everywhere, across throughout the cosmos, throughout the world. And then verse 9, where we'll start today, brings it back to the person. Now sort of circling back to the actual being who's trying to do this, you know, how do you physically do this? You know, this is all sounds good, but how do you actually do this? And it says, well, you do it from your body, you know, it's not just an idea, and you bring this up when you're walking, when you're standing, when you're sitting or lying down. And that list of 4 postures shows up in the Pali Canon all the time, and so those 4 postures sort of stand for all postures. So it includes sleeping and talking on the phone and going to the toilet, you know, all postures that you can imagine. And then one thing that's interesting, just sort of textually, about the ninth verse. What was I going to say about this? Oh, yeah, one thing about this, about the ninth verse, which is pretty well left out of our translation, or just suggested by our translation, is the first half, in the Pali, the first half says about practice with all these postures. It doesn't really say all the time, but it implies that. But the second half of the second couplet in the ninth verse actually brings up this metta practice within the context of a set of a critical set of four practices. So if you look at the last line in Pali of the ninth verse, you see Brahmam etam viharam. And so this is referencing the Brahma viharas. The Brahma viharas. So Brahma is both a Hindu sort of all-knowing God, but it also sort of indicates sort of perfection, or sort of absolute. And vihara are places where you could live, places where you can abide. So the Brahma viharas are sometimes they're called. God, I'm blanking on what else they get called. Sometimes they're called the four immeasurables. They have a bunch of different names. But the Brahma Viharas are four sort of key practices. And they are, first is this metta practice. But then this is saying, do metta practice in the context of all four. And you're supposed to know, because you've been a monk all your life, you already know the other three, right? So the other three, the second one is compassion, practice of compassion, karuna. The third one, mudita, is really good for us. It's translated sympathetic joy or appreciative joy. And that's the practice of being really happy for other people. So it's the opposite of jealousy. Somebody else, something good happens to someone else, you feel it like it was something good happened to you. You know, like, oh, darn it, I wish I had gotten them. You know, gone to school and done that. No, you're happy for them. And then the fourth of the four Brahma Vihara practices is equanimity, you know, just steadiness, you know. And in Zen, we talk about that a lot when we say just being upright. So not leaning into things, not pulling back from things, just being present, you know, and equanimous with things. And so our translation kind of alludes to this a little bit, saying, let one practice the way with gratitude. But really, the word gratitude is not in the Pali original at all. But this idea of practicing with gratitude suggests, I think, there's a broader feeling here, you know. Because gratitude, you know, if you think about gratitude has a sort of boundless quality. You know, it's not my gratitude exactly. It's not gratitude for something, it's just gratitude. And Thanissaro Bhikkhu's translation of this ninth verse also kind of references the Brahma Viharas, these four immeasurable practices, but also a sort of insider references, he says. This is called the sublime abiding here and now.
Who translated that?
Well, I need to find out. I don't really know. A committee, I think, you know. Some committee, you know. Yeah, I don't really know. We adopted a whole set of translations because the Soto Zen Church sponsored a big translation conference about, I don't know, 8 years ago, a while ago, with the idea being that it would be great if American Soto Zen could have, like, standardized, like, how do we always chant the Heart Sutra? You know, how do we chant the other things, the different things in the chant book? You know, leaving the little chant before the class, before Dharma talk. Because those all come from standardized Japanese chants that are consistently the same. So if you go to any Zen center anywhere in the world, if they're chanting the Heart Sutra in Japanese, it's always exactly the same, and so it's kind of cool. But, you know, when you go to a new country, everyone has a different take on it and wants to say it their way, and translation is, as we're seeing, an interpretive process. So anyway, the Soto Zen Church kind of wanted this, and San Francisco Zen Center helped them, and other American Zen groups helped them. So they did this big translation conference, and that's where most of our new chant book comes from. the way we chant the Heart Sutra changed, and you know, the merging of difference and unity is a translation of a 9th century Chinese poem, you know. But sort of with that whole group of stuff, we got the Metta Sutta, which had a few changes. But the Metta Sutta is not a traditional Zen chant. And, you know, it gets translated from Pali, not from Japanese anyway, so I don't know. I'll have to find out. And now we have mixed views about it now that we studied it, you know. It's better in some ways just not to know, you know, just to chant.
So what are the Theravada folks use?
Well, in all the Southeast Asian countries, they chant it in Pali, even if their spoken language is Thai or Burmese or Sinhalese or something like that. So they just use Pali as a lingua franca. And the Theravadan American groups, I don't know if they, that's a good question. We should see if the American or the English-speaking Theravadan groups have a standard translation. They might, I don't know. But it's probably closer to the middle column here, which is more literal. And a lot of the sort of interpretive stuff in ours seems to be a sort of a Mahayana sort of gloss or take on things, which in a way is good for us, you know what I mean? Because we might be a little bit confused or limited by some of the more literal stuff from early Buddhism. So anyway, now the final verse, closing in on the end of the sutta. I always used to be quite amused by going to classes and stuff where, you know, the class is on like a one-page text, you know. And I thought, well, why is it a 4 or 5 session class, you know? How much can there be to say? But it turns out a lot, especially if you really look at the words. So there's some really interesting stuff here in this last verse and stuff that's more challenging for us and so therefore is more interpretive in our translation. So the first stanza, pretty much means what it says. Not holding to fixed views, endowed with insight, freed from sense appetites, or not taken with views, but virtuous and consummate in vision. See, that doesn't roll off the tongue, really, does it? Virtuous and consummate in vision. Can't chant that. And that's the other problem is something that might be more literal or more helpful might not chant very well, you know? It might be like, you know, to chant. And then having subdued desire for sensual pleasures. So both these are pretty much the same list. One thing is left out of ours, the first word in the second line of the first stanza, silava. So that's sila again, so that's morality. Morality with a case ending, sila. And so what's interesting about this stanza is it's a list of qualities but without the imperative verbs that they're using at the beginning. So this is not saying you should now also do all this stuff. It's saying that a natural result, you know, or arising from metta practice will be that you're this way. So the first section where do this, do that, do this, do that, this is saying now you've done that. Here's what happens. Here's what you get, you know. Here's what occurs naturally. Naturally you're not caught in views. You know, naturally you're, you know, not sort of grabby about sensory pleasures, you know. You just accept things as you come. You're not like so driven by wanting things to be a particular way. And that this is all just sort of the natural development or sort of result of loving kindness, that these qualities arise. And it kind of makes sense if you think about it, you know. If you can consistently bring up love and kindness for other people, like all the time, you know, unconditionally, very, you know, very accepting, very positive, you know, really wishing and believing in the best for other people all the time, then it makes sense that your views would get softer, you know, because what are our most closely held views about? They're about people, you know, they're about relationships, they're about, you know, ideology, which is also really about people and about relationships. And if you think about the opposite, you know, when we're very sort of conditional in our loving, you know, I'll love you and support you if you would just straighten out, if you would just do this, if you would just do that. The reason why we think that is because we're already sort of fixed that person, you know what I mean? We fix them in as a sort of type of person or sort of category, or you always do this, you always do that, I hate it when you do that, you know. And And there's a way also that when we do that, and when everyone else does that, we're sort of colluding, you know, in a sort of fixing of that person, you know what I mean? We're sort of holding them in a certain state with our fixed views. You know, what you think about it is kind of ironic, because then we're doing the opposite of what we want, right? We're telling the person, you know, you're this way, you know, and I will love you more if you were that way. But the more we tell them you're this way, the more we're just, you know, helping them be this way, not that way, you know what I mean? So this result of not having fixed views seems like it would and does arise naturally. You know, I accept you the way you are. I love you. I feel the pain that you're feeling. You know, we bring up the other four, or the other three of those four practices at the same time. I'm compassionate. I can feel the pain you're feeling. I can feel joy for your successes, and I'm not knocked over by you either way. You know, I'm equanimous in this relationship. You know, you can be this way. You can be that way. I'll still be here. You know. I'm staying put. And these other qualities you can look at the same way, you know. Freed from sense appetites, you know, I'm not, you know, sort of desiring any particular input from the situation, you know what I mean? It can go this way, it can go that way, you know, you can, you know, of course I have a preference. It's not saying that one is freed from preferences exactly. I still would prefer that we have a warm, loving conversation, you don't yell at me, you know. But I'm not attached to having a warm and loving conversation. I'm going to do what seems appropriate and helpful based on my understanding and based on my unconditional love for you. So that's the first half of the stanza. So that, I just want to note that. I mean, because we can't really tell from the English exactly. It seems like a list of qualities, kind of list of people, list of more qualities, and it kind of all runs together. But this last part is like, you know, this is what you get. And so that's why they consider... this last section to be the wisdom section of the sutra. Like this is the sort of inner meaning and the inner result of doing these this metta practice. That this is like what arises out of that. And then the very last phrase of the sutra, you know, the last stanza, very end, here we see a big difference between the two translations, which is for a reason. Ours says, one who achieves the way, which is just kind of a bridge, but then it says, will be freed from the duality of birth and death. Tanisaro Bhikkhu says, blah, 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 one never again will lie in the womb. Never again will lie in the womb. So what's all this about? So the literal translation of the Pali there, that nahi jatu gaba sayam punar etiti, actually means, I'm doing my talk in a different order from my notes. I wrote out the literal translation of this for you. Trying to have metta for myself because I'm losing the thread today. Well, anyway, it basically what it means is something literally like one will never enter into the womb with the result of being born, or maybe never again. So it's of course closer to Tanisaro Bhikkhu's. So what's this all about? So traditional Buddhism says a lot about rebirth, which they tend to sort of skip over in the American places because we don't believe in it. But I think it's important to learn a little bit about what they were teaching and what they meant, and then we can work with that in whatever way we want, which could include just ignoring it and going about our day. So you can just make it with what you want. So traditional Buddhism is very involved in rebirth, and we've talked before about the different realms, that you're born into different realms, and we are born into the human realm, which is propitious for us. And good, right? Because in the human realm, there's both suffering and the ability to cognize suffering, and therefore the ability to learn teachings and do something about it. And it's traditionally seen that once you take up the practice, it's not just one lifetime to attain liberation. It traditionally takes 4 to 7 lives. 4 to 7 lives, yeah. And along the way, there's different stages that you reach. And so in traditional Buddhism, there are four different stages. And so this is alluding to that. And the stages can happen over multiple lifetimes too. So the first stage is you somehow have an experience, and this is real too, within one lifetime. So you can see it literally or more immediately. So the first stage is you have some deep feeling from the practice. You know, something shifts. You know, it may or may not be a big, glorious, exciting experience that you can come tell somebody about. It might just be a subtle sort of feeling. Some feeling of sort of opening or connection. You know, you have to feel something. And once you do, then you've achieved the level of the stream enterer. The stream enterer, one who's entered the stream. You know, they use the analogy of going down a stream to the end. You've entered the stream of Dharma. And once you've entered the stream of Dharma, it is guaranteed, it says, that you will attain liberation within 7 rebirths. So you are all at least stream enterers, so you're good now. 7 lifetimes only. At the worst, you know, could be better. And then, at some point, you have another sort of deepening of your understanding or your connection to practice, and you become a once-returner. So first stream enterer, then a once-returner. And these are like literal translations of the Pali and Sanskrit terms. But they're sort of, there's only really one way to translate them. So the once returner means, like it sounds, one more rebirth at most, and then liberation. And then you keep practicing, and you may progress to the level of the non-returner, which means this is the last lifetime. That's really good. You're not going to return. But you may or may not be liberated. You might just, I guess it's possible to become a non-returner. And then the last stage is an arahant in Pali, or arhat in Sanskrit. Arhat in Sanskrit. And I'm not sure, you know, what if you're a non-returner and you die and you don't become an arhat? I'm not sure what happens to you. I'll have to find out. Because the arhat is the fully awakened one in traditional Buddhism. And it usually says in the Pali Canon, when someone becomes an arhat, if a thought arises in you, what had to be done was done. There's no more to be done. You know, basically, this is it. You know, I'm settled now. You know, and this has a sort of psychological and metaphorical reality to us. What if we were completely liberated from this feeling that we always seem to have of all this stuff we have to do, you know? What if we were really just content, you know? What has been done is done, you know? There's no more to come. There's no more to come, I say. So that's the arhat. So yeah, I'm having a little sort of theological problem with non-returner, though. What happens to the non-returners if they don't become arhats? I don't know. And then the Mahayana schools elaborated further on this. They said, I'm out of order. So then the arhat, the basic idea of the arhat is that when they die, they're not reborn. And to us, that doesn't sound too great, you know, because of our attachment, you know. We like being me, and it has its problems, you know. There's some things we'd like cleaned up and improved, please, but we basically like being me. And if there was rebirth, wouldn't it be nice just to have another chance, you know, and you could do a little better next time, you know, probably. Maybe things would be a little nicer, you know, or maybe a little worse, but, you know, at least it'd be another chance, you know. You kind of take the sting out of death, right? But the way it's understood is, and here's a quote from an encyclopedia, rebirth in Buddhism is the doctrine that the consciousness of a person upon the death or dissolution of the aggregates, so the aggregates are sort of the categories of experience that we think is us, the death or dissolution of the aggregates, you know, death, the consciousness becomes one of the contributing causes for the arising of a new group of skandhas, so a new person. The consciousness arising in the new person, this is interesting, consciousness arising in the new person is neither identical to nor entirely different from the old consciousness, but it forms part of the causal continuum or stream with it. And the basic cause for this persistent re-arising of personality is the abiding of consciousness in ignorance. And when ignorance is uprooted, rebirth ceases. So in other words, if you look at life more squarely from the point of view, so they're saying if you look at life more squarely from the point of view of suffering and the end of suffering, and you release yourself completely from your sort of attachment to your personality and yourself, then you see, the only reason why, you know, consciousness wants to be reborn is consciousness is so grabby and confused, you know what I mean? And it thinks there's like stuff to do and things to improve and stuff to get rid of and problems to avoid, and you know, consciousness has this quality of ignorance, you know, of not understanding the way things really go. And so consciousness is sort of like momentum, you know. And that momentum causes rebirth, but it's not really you. You know, it's just that you set this sort of suffering momentum out there, you know, plowing across, you know, sort of the fields, and then you're reborn again. And so from that point of view, it's a good thing for you and a good thing for the world if you would just quietly, you know, fade out, you know. Just be quiet for once, you know. But then the Mahayana school said, well, that's okay as far as it goes, but what about all those beings who are left behind, you know? So the Mahayana vision is either after the Arhat or instead of the Arhat, we have the Bodhisattva, the enlightening being, the awakening being. And the Bodhisattva does all these cultivations, you know, does progress in the path and all this. But then when the sort of option, when the option arises to just cease, the Bodhisattva says, well, no, I'm going to go back. I'm going to be reborn as long as necessary in the human realm to help other beings. And, you know, until the, you know, and I will not, you know, enter nirvana until the last being is, you know, I'll be the last through the door kind of thing. And so, from the point of view of traditional Buddhism, no more rebirth is like the best possible outcome, right? And so, the way the sutta ends by saying, the results of this practice are, you're not caught in fixed views, you know, you have good vision, you know, blah, 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 and you're never again going to be reborn. So that's like the highest possible praise for the, you know, this is like, that's saying this is the best possible practice because you're going to be released from suffering. And what we're saying here in our translation, I think this is pretty good, actually. This is a good Mahayana translation for us, but it is a reinterpretation. And what ours is saying is freed from the duality of birth and death. And so what that means is, that means that we can stay within the world, but not suffer, because we are freed from this idea we have that, you know, death, meaning destruction, decay, literal death, things falling apart, you know, relationship ending, you know, all these different kinds of deaths. You know, we basically think death is bad, right? And birth is good, you know, new things, brand new car, new relationships, new babies are born, you know, all these new things, you know. We would like just all the new things and none of the, you know, we want just birth and not death. And so the way it's understood is that's sort of the engine, you know, that's the engine of suffering, that we have that idea and we believe in it so completely. And, you know, and we have, you know, we're not sort of blind to that, you know, we have like ideas like, letting go, you know, we have ideas like having a good death, you know, but, you know, really, we don't really believe in that, you know, a good death, you know, no, death is bad, you know. So this idea of being freed from that duality means, you know, not, you know, sort of like we become dumb and we think, oh, he didn't really die. No, he died. But we're not... you know, it's sort of, it's an imaginative act from our point of view, right? Because we're caught in this duality. But what we're trying to imagine here is, you know, what if we could see birth and death with sort of complete equanimity, back to equanimity, you know? You know, when we say, oh, death is sad, but it's natural, to really, actually really believe that, you know, not just, you know, because I know, I think we can say that, especially if it's a death sort of at a distance, or they were 87 and a half at least, or, you know, somebody weren't that, you know, we can kind of say it, you know, but do we really believe it? I think there's always a part of us that said, but oh, if only, you know, if only there could be no death, you know, so terrible. So this freedom from that is to, you know, be completely accepting of that, you know, not resistant to death at all, not upset by death, you know, seeing when, you know, when the car breaks, you know, seeing, oh, it's the nature of cars to break. You know, the universe is still functioning correctly. This is good, you know, no problem. call the mechanic, you know. And the same thing with birth, you know, to not sort of lean into birth and desire always new things and fresh experiences. And, you know, and there's so many different kinds of births we desire, right? Like, it's like that's like why we travel, right? We're desiring, you know, we got many long emails from Barb from the Caribbean where basically this wasn't working, right? I mean, that's basically the great cause of suffering for you guys in the Caribbean, you know? A complete new life was not born on that little island, you know? And the same old damn life was there, and, you know, not to give you guys a hard time because we all do that, you know? We all do that.
Can I respond to this?
Mm-hmm, please, yeah.
So it's really different, the one that we have and then the other one.
Yeah.
Because what we're saying is it's sort of like enlightenment. Mm-hmm. We see it as non-dual and nothing changes.
Right.
Just except the way we understand it.
Right.
Where in the other one they're saying you've come to some point where this happens, you're no longer.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what we're really saying is we really understand it as a whole concept, life and death.
Right, life and death, yeah, exactly, yeah. And they use that phrase sometimes as one word in Japanese, life and death, yeah. Yeah.
That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very good, yeah, good way to say it.
What is the source of this whole idea of reincarnation? Where did it come from?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if I really know, but I mean, it was certainly part of the dominant Indian philosophy and theology of the Buddha's day, and continues to be the case in most of Asia, you know, as a dominant idea. And, you know, and I think it would be interesting for someone to do some research on that. You know, like, you know, when Christianity came along, was Christianity bringing up a new idea? You know what I mean? Are we the ones that sort of inherited this new idea that we think is what everyone should have thought, that, you know, that heaven and hell is permanent and it's sort of one shot at it, you know. But then there's this eternal soul who just sort of keeps existing, you know, in the good place or the bad place or in between, I guess. What is purgatory? Who had this good Catholic education?
Yeah,
what is purgatory?
Well, purgatory is like the place where if you die and you haven't been to confession, you have sins on your soul, you get them kind of cleaned up.
Oh, okay.
So, in the old days, I don't know if they do it anymore, but you could go in and you could, you know, you pay a little money and you light a little votive candle and you can burn off some of your years in purgatory by doing certain things.
Oh, I see.
So, it's the middle place between heaven and
earth. It sort of sounded like the one you were going to do some research on. They reach the stage where they're not going to be born again.
Right. Is that like purgatory? Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
So it certainly sounds as if they have a very low opinion of being here if the ideal is to not have to come back.
Well, it does sound that way, but it's Buddhism's main interest is freedom from suffering, you know? And so, in a way, you could kind of combine the two theologies. You know, you could say Buddhism is multiple lifetimes to get to this place where you have a very beautiful life free of suffering, and then that's enough. You know, and that's enough. So that'd be one way to look at it. And maybe the Christians are kind of want that now. You know, one life now with God. You know, is heaven. Heaven is here. You know, heaven is on earth. Although it seems like some of them are like, well, this life is nothing but misery and pain, and the real life will be in heaven. Seems a little contradictory of all of this. But yeah, let me, I want to research more about this rebirth stuff, because we kind of can't avoid it, you know what I mean? You can put it off only so long, you know? Then we're all going to die and wonder what happens, you know?
So, the people who reach the point where they no longer need to be reborn, then where are they?
And then where? Well, the energy that is the consciousness just dissipates, you know. So in a way, you're everywhere, you know what I mean? One way to look at it is you're everywhere. You know, the molecules in the body, you know, like we know from science, you know, after you die, you know, no matter what happens to your body, burned, whatever, you know, the same molecules still
exist.
So same atoms still exist. The molecules could get rearranged. And now it's part of everything, you know. And so, yeah, I suppose, you know, when the Arhat dies and is not reborn, you know, because already they understand the death of the body pretty much the same as Western thinking, you know, that the body just becomes part of everything. But the way they understand it is consciousness, like I was saying, has this kind of momentum, which sets sort of the wheel in motion for a new baby to be, you know, born and enter this life, you know, of suffering and confusion, you know, if you don't understand it right. But, you know, and the way we, a lot of the way we look at it now is, you know, we can look on all this stuff. You can also look at all this stuff as on a sort of moment-by-moment basis, you know, almost like a really, you know, one way to look at it is like a really smart sort of spiritual psychology, too, you know. And in a way, every moment we're reborn, you know. And if we can accept that, then we're much more sort of, there's a lot more possibilities for us. We're much more fluid, you know. If we think it's one fixed, permanent life, and then that's it, you know, then we're stuck. But if we're saying, well, in every moment we're reborn, you know, every moment is a possible rebirth into a more positive, you know, life with less suffering, or a hell, you know, or we can kind of bliss out into heaven for a while, but forget what we're really trying to do in life, you know. You know, conditions can get really, you know, so we can also understand it that way. But I just wanted to tell you that that is actually the point that they're making traditionally at the end of the sutra. That the practice of metta, and the other way to understand it is, you know, not to get hung up so much on rebirth, but that what they're saying is that the practice of metta is so good that it has the best possible outcome, you know. And from the point of view of traditional Buddhism, the best possible outcome is become an arhat, not be reborn again. You know, from the point of view maybe of postmodern American Buddhism, it's, you know, freedom from suffering, you know. The ability to be with suffering beings in the suffering world as a bodhisattva, you know, present and feeling, you know, aware, but equanimous, not, you know, not adding pain to our pain. Yeah, we'll cope with it over there. And so then I thought, you know, as our last thing in our last class here is, you know, let's return kind of again to the idea of not all this as an idea so much, but metta practice, you know, as an effective daily life practice. So I have a couple of quotes for you. So the first is from the Buddha, and this is an important point because one of the things that all these practices bring up is we do actually have a deeply held view that our personality is fixed because of the belief in the permanence of self, right? We think this is me and this is how I am, right? And, you know, if that was really fluid, then how could there really be a me there? You know what I mean? So there's a way that our sort of belief in self is sort of kind of a fixative, you know what I mean? You know, like you make a pastel painting and you spray fixative on there so it won't change, you know? So the Buddhist understanding is not that way at all. And that's important for us, and I think a great offering for the world if we can live that. That doing these practices can completely change, you know, the personality, the psychology, the way the thoughts work. You know, that the thoughts arise based on conditions, not based on me. And that we can change those conditions, and different thoughts will arise, and different actions and different attitudes and different feelings will flow from that change. And so I looked up a little bit what else the Buddha said about metta. In another sutta, somewhere else, he said, "Cultivate the good, O monks." We can substitute loving kindness for good if we want. "Cultivate the good, O monks. One can cultivate what is good. For were it not possible to cultivate the good, I would not ask you to do so. But as it can be done, therefore I say, cultivate the good. If this cultivation of the good would bring harm and suffering, I would not ask you to cultivate it. But as the cultivation of good brings benefit and happiness, therefore I say, cultivate the good." I have these lovely sort of repetitious way of talking, you know. So in other words, this is not, you know, these practices are not just like a nice thing to do. They actually rewire, you know. And like, you know, like now you read stuff from brain science, right? They're realizing that brain, you know, connections are, you know, they talk about neuroplasticity, right? Everything can be rewired and changed in the way, you know, they used to think that basically the brain at adolescence was like fixed, basically fixed and degrading, you know, just you have your certain amount of stuff and the cells start dying until you die. But now they're realizing things regenerate and change all the time in the brain. So that seems to line up with this. And then another quote, this is the Dalai Lama. He was a great sort of exemplar of somehow being positive, you know. And you think about the Dalai Lama, you know, it sort of doesn't make rational sense that he'd be positive about anything, you know. You know, his country was invaded, you know, he lost everything, you know, and the Tibetan people are repressed and, you know, in terrible shape. But he really works with that, and part of how he works with that is this kind of loving-kindness practice. And he said, I believe that the very purpose of life is to be happy. For from the very core of our being, we desire contentment. In my own limited experience, I have found that the more we care for the happiness of others, so metta practice, the more we care for the happiness of others, the greater is our own sense of well-being. Cultivating a close, warm-hearted feeling for others automatically puts the mind at ease. It helps remove whatever fears or insecurities we have and gives us the strength to cope with any obstacles we encounter. It is the principal source of success in life. Since we are not solely material creatures, it is a mistake to place all of our hope for happiness on external development alone. The key is to develop inner peace. So that's what he thinks. It seems to work for him. So anyway, I bring all this up at the end because it seems like that's kind of one of our big, great obstacles is this tremendous sort of belief we have. You know, we have to realize the sort of weight of that and the strength of that. That, well, yeah, that's all nice and good, but I'm going to revert to my old habits and I'm still going to be this way and, you know, yada, yada, yada. And, you know, there's a sort of a level of, you know, we can sort of, you know, there's sort of like part of us that thinks, well, I can sort of, you know, dull the pain a little bit. I could, you know, kind of have some nice experiences. Maybe when I have a lot of support in the Zendo and so on, but, you know, fundamentally, you know, there's some part of us that thinks, yeah, but there's no real hope for me, you know. I'm a wreck, you know. So it's good to read these things and realize, well, you know, the Buddha actually said, no, you know. You can rewire the way you are. You know, you can change where you are. You can cultivate the good. And the Dalai Lama says in the face of anything, including your country being invaded and all these horrible things happening, that just cultivating warm feelings for others, just that, you know, he says, just cultivating a close, warm-hearted feeling for others puts the mind at ease, removes fears and insecurities, and gives us strength, and is the principal source of success in life. So these are not small claims, you know. The Buddha is saying it has the ultimate positive outcome. Dalai Lama saying much the same. So anyway, you know, we still treasure, you know, in the Zen tradition, we treasure zazen and emptiness and just the quiet, you know, and we trust that these things will arise naturally, and they do, you know. You know, we have a great faith, you know, in sort of our original, sort of awakened nature, you know, that naturally, you know, if we quiet down, let the thoughts settle, let the judgment settle, loving kindness will arise. And the earlier Buddhism was a little more prescriptive, you know. The Buddha, one of the ways the Buddha was talked about was as a doctor. A doctor who saw the ills of the world and like basically wrote prescriptions, you know. A metta practice, put that on your, you know, take that to the pharmacy, you know. And so it seems to me what's great, we have a great opportunity now is, well, we can learn also about these prescriptive practices, you know, but do them with this spirit, you know, of the sort of our original wholeness, you know. And as it makes sense, you know, practice metta. And I really do recommend it in daily life, you know, just, yeah, you see, and the closer they are to you, a little trickier it gets, you know, but see, you know, somebody that you, and we talked about doing metta for the people you don't see, you know. So to actually see people, you know, oh, may you be happy. Okay, now what? You know, you know, instead of starting with, oh, God damn it, you know, here you are again, you know. You know, or here I am again, you know, or here we are again in this situation. You know, like, or may we be happy, you know, in this situation. Okay, now. Now that I brought that up, let's work with this, you know, as best we can from where we're at, you know. So that's my little class in the Metta Sutta.
Question.
Yeah, so let's end with discussion.
I felt that I shouldn't use the metta as a substitution for the zazen. So I just
did
morning zazen alone, but then I do this. That would probably be what you would recommend. Is not to substitute this.
Well, you know, I don't know, you know, it does seem to be helpful to actually practice metta during meditation.
I meditated on metta.
Yeah.
But then I don't do it at my record. Zazen time.
I
guess it doesn't matter.
Both are good, you know, good. And, you know, I think maybe what's skillful for us is to take up a particular practice, like metta practice, for a while, you know, for a month or a year or whatever, you know, when it seems helpful, you know. During zazen, you know, or some combination, you know, when we sit down to settle and just practice emptiness for a while, you know, and then bring up metta practice. I don't know, you know, I think it's sort of a creative thing, but I think you're right with your basic impulse is always returning to silence, you know, always returning to zazen, you know, formless practice with no goal and no outcome, and just, you know, because the downside of sort of bringing up these practices is then we kind of make a project out of it, you know, and are we failing, are we succeeding? And the great, wonderful, you know, sort of benefit of Zazen is you can't fail at it, you know, and you can't succeed either, you know what I mean? You just give it space, you know, you just allow Zazen to be Zazen. And so, I don't know, Mike, and then it can be helpful to work with a teacher, too, to say, you know, my practice seems such and so, you know, to get a little input, but we're kind of our own best teacher, too, so yeah, you know. I don't know, some of both, you know, yeah.
I kind of wonder about that too myself, but I notice like I go through, I do Tanglin for quite some period of time, mm-hmm. and something will shift in my life, and all of a sudden it just gets too heavy for me,
mm-hmm.
and then I just find naturally I have to go back for a while and just sit, so it kind of just tends to evolve on it, it's all kind of for me.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and you kind of trust your inner wisdom, yeah, in that way, and, you know.
I have another thought. I have been so perplexed by the notion of reincarnation,
uh-huh.
how there could be no self, you know, then what is it that reincarnates?
I right.
mean, you know, there no soul in all that
right.
Christian sense. And so you're saying that it's consciousness.
Yeah.
That the consciousness, that whatever consciousness existed before
mm-hmm.
the death creates a momentum.
Yeah.
Cause and effect still continues in other
right.
words.
Right.
And somehow, but
somehow that contributes to a constellation of factors and then a new being is born, you know.
With.
You know, factors including like biology, you know, and all that, you know.
Right, okay, yeah. But all those, but all that stuff from the past life is still
right.
manifests itself in this constellation.
Somehow, yeah, I mean, the, you know, I can't read the encyclopedia entry again, but yeah, you know, I mean, they seem to be saying, yeah, I don't really know, you know, is what it comes down to, but yeah, they seem to be saying that, yeah, the new sort of being, you know, has some elements, there's some something from the old consciousness, but it's not like
yeah.
Kathy version 3, you know.
Yeah, right.
But it has some energy from
the previous
like Kathy, yeah. Yeah, right, and then there's the whole, the Tibetan stuff about recognizing incarnated lamas, you know, and the way
yes.
they can recognize
yeah.
stuff, you know, objects from the previous life, and,
yeah.
and, you know, events, they can remember things, and, you know, I don't know what to make of all that, you know, and,
yeah.
you know, it's hard to know. But, I mean, one way to look at it all is, you know, there's also an obvious way that all the people that know the person continue them in a way too, right? You know, when somebody dies, it's not like we just forget about them the next second, you know what I mean? They continue to be a force in their life, you know, and sort of gradually fade, although not even in a linear way. Some, you know. So maybe there's a way that sort of collectively we're, you know, sort of bringing them to rebirth, you know, there's a way that we just sort of continue each other, you know. It's like a chain, you know, a chain of beings. And one of the ways that they understand consciousness in Buddhism is that our individual consciousness is connected to a sort of universal consciousness, a little bit like the Jungian collective unconscious. They have something like that called the storehouse consciousness.
Well, I have to think, I mean, there was some mechanism that got us here in the first place.
Right, you know,
so,
yeah. Somehow we got here, yeah,
yeah.
Somehow. Right. It's very
yeah.
unlikely, isn't it? You know, if you think about your life. Your life is very unlikely. You know, how could this have happened? You know.
I feel comfortable saying, I really just don't know that.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
I mean, I could see, you know, all that stuff, but I really don't know that. I don't know if I'll ever be able to understand that.
Right.
Yeah. Not in the way we think.
Yeah.
Right. Right, because we think from the point of view of a person, right?
Yeah.
So these are non-person based. You know, this is teachings about the universe, not from the point of view of a person. From the point of view, so like the five skandhas, you remember about that, you know, that what we think as a person is really just a collection of experiences that can be sort of categorized and organized in a different way, you know. My, you know, Tim is one possible organizing principle for all the experiences that this consciousness cognizes, you know, but it's not the only possible story here. It's just the one that I, you know, believe in. But sometimes, and sometimes, you know, and you know, you may not even notice this, but sometimes in meditation, you know, the sense of consciousness, a sense of sort of personhood fades, you know what I mean? And there's this sort of just breathing, you know, or just experiencing, or like, you know, like when sometimes a meditation period seems to go by in an instant. So what happened, you know? You know? And it seems to be what happened is our usual sort of story of this is me, I heard that, I saw that, I felt that, I'm thinking that, I, you know, that's where we sort of chain things together to create a sense of time, you know? So when that stops happening, it seems like there's no time, you know? But surely this body was still sitting there, you know? And, but was there a person there, you know? Were you there, you know? What is you? And so I think that's kind of part of this process and thinking about rebirth and stuff is, you know, being sensitive to the possibility of the parts of my life that are not me, you know what I mean? Or can you even say my life, you know, when life is just arising, you know, what is that, you know? And can that be a sort of counterweight to the sort of self, you know, self-induced sort of dream that we live? Anyway, to be continued, I'm sure. Any other thoughts, or it's about time to go?
I don't know if you'd call this an ultimate question, but one thing that occurs to me from time to time about not just this idea that we're discussing here, but I have a friend who's a Jehovah's Witness, and
she describes
this really elaborate thing.
Oh, they know what's going to happen, yeah.
About Adam and Eve disobeyed, and so God said, well, all it can do now is play itself out. But the idea is that eventually the human race, given time, will realize the error of its ways. And everybody will say, oh, this isn't working. You know, we really do need to obey God.
Yeah.
And suddenly everything will be okay. And when she was explaining all this to me, my thought was, why bother? If God, the idea, the original God idea, or God's idea was, given time, you jerks will finally figure out that you've got to follow my rules, etc. And I was sort of thinking, if you just had never created Adam and Eve in the first place, you wouldn't have had to go through all this.
Yeah.
And I sort of think the same thing about this.
Yeah.
Why bother?
Uh-huh.
And obviously, if nobody bothered, then none of this would ever have existed.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah. Well, why bother? I mean, and then the Buddhist answer to that, I suppose, is why bother is because, you know, on a moment-by-moment experiential level, we can see more and more clearly that, you know, some choices that we make lead to suffering and pain.
Oh,
you know,
my question, why bother, is not on a, on an individual basis. Uh-huh. It's a universal creator concept of what you're describing or what the Jehovah's Witnesses describe, the whole thing.
Yeah,
if you're the creator and you're thinking about creating all of this, the question would be, why bother?
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah. Well, the Buddhist answer is there's no creator, right? It's just conditions, just conditions come together in a certain constellation.
There's nobody to point to and say, hey, why did you create this mess?
Yeah. Right, but but you could still ask the question, why did this arise? And when the Buddha's asked that, he said, well, it's there's no beginning. It's beginningless, you know.
So. And that's an impossible concept.
Right. Well, exactly. It's a non-conceptual sort of
impossible
answer. Yeah. Yeah. You can't think about that conceptually. Yeah. It's beginningless and endless, you know. So anyway.
You know, and my Jehovah's Witness friend said at one point when I was saying, "Why really? As if I'm God and I'm thinking about all this stuff, why would I bother?" Just even began.
Yeah.
She said, well, then, Joan, you know, there never would have been you, and don't you get any pleasure out of your life at all?
Yeah.
And I said, yes, sure, lots, but it's limited by the knowledge that there's so much suffering around.
Right.
That's the limitation.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big theological problem for them that God is omniscient, you know, I mean, so why did, you know, but why this and why that, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't have that problem so much in Buddhism, but we still wonder why. Yeah.
But why suffering?
Why suffering? Yeah. Well, because conditions were such that suffering arose, you know. Yeah. It's just the, you know, so the Buddhist answer is like, well, it's just it's the hand you were dealt. You want to complain about it or do something, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, you're in the middle of the game. It's been going on since before the beginning of time, and you got to make your play, you know. So yeah.
There's nobody to accuse.
There's nobody to blame.
Right.
And you can't. And then the other thing that's helpful there is you can't even blame yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not your fault.
Yeah, I have to remind myself.
It's not your
that.
Fault. Yeah, you
no,
just.
I didn't create the world.
Right.
I worry about it. But I think. Hey,
right.
I didn't
create it. Right.
Yeah.
We're responsible, you know, but it's not our fault.
So Bodhisattva would continue, I mean, in the light of reincarnation, always.
Yeah, they just keep coming
always,
back, yeah.
Always coming back.
Yeah. Yeah, they delay Buddhahood, it said, yeah. Yeah. So it's sort of ultimate commitment, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, I hope this was useful in some way, and
sure.
We can keep thinking about these things. And
now, is this the last class?
This is the last class.
Well,
and then I'm on vacation for 2 weeks, and then I'll think, or you can think too, about what should we do with this little, I'd like to keep offering stuff on Friday after sitting.
Yeah. For me, it's really good to have them on Friday after.
Yeah, so maybe class, so we think what that should be, and keep going with more classes. We'll miss poor Kathy after she goes back to work, but we'll keep the seat warm till next summer, you know, if we live that long. And so you can be thinking if you want another class or to do other kinds of things.
I guess.